Human Services Budget Division will come to order. We have another long list of bills today, so I'd like to get started. Senator Marty has someone here that needs to testify that can't stay, so I think we'll take Senate File 1095 first. And welcome back, Senator Marty. I hope you're feeling well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm doing better. Senate File 1055 deals with the parental contribution, the TEFRA payments, and the parental responsibility portion of that. And if I think we all remember in 2003, we had the parental contribution jump up very significantly. You were able to bring it down a little bit a couple years ago. This is one more attempt to bring it down further, and I realize it's all going to be a matter of budget, but I have Tim Anderson here.
Stanley,
here to speak to the bill, and I appreciate your taking it early because she has some young kids here who are waiting around patiently. So.
Yes. Thank you. My name is Kim Stanley, and I am the mother of two children with special needs. Courtney, 9, has Fragile X, ADHD, anxiety disorder, dyslexia, and learning disabilities. Alex is 7 and has autism, disruptive behavior disorder, seizures, and OCD. I am a stay-at-home mom that homeschools for reasons that we won't get into today. When I was asked to speak today about a million things went through my head on what to say. I could tell you how hard it is for our families, but you already know that. I could tell you we need more help than we are getting, but you already know that. Or I could tell you how you can help, but you already know that too. So I decided to talk about all of it just to make sure you really understand what our lives are like and why we really need your help lowering the parental fee for TEFRA. With all that I do and with who I am, I do not have time to beat around the bush or sugarcoat anything. So what I am going to say today will be straightforward as to what the legislature needs to do and why. I have heard that there may be a surplus this year, and if there is, I am sure everyone has an idea of how to spend it. Transportation is right up there at the top, as is education and health care. All of these are important and affect all of us either directly or indirectly. Health care happens to affect us very directly. As I said, I have two children with special needs. Raising two spirited typical children is always a challenge, but raising two spirited children with special needs is hard. We have a new legislature in both the House and the Senate this year, and we will also have a lot of children being diagnosed with disabilities this year, both developmental and physical. So what does that mean to our new legislators? A whole lot. In 2003, when some of the legislature decided that the disabled and elderly were the ones to balance the budget by raising the parental fees and prescription copays, it was one of the most counterproductive moves they could have done. It backfired on them, and we still had a budget deficit, and a lot of people either dropped TEFRA because they couldn't afford it, the increased fee, or the families are in debt up to their eyeballs with the state. We are in the latter category. My husband, who also is disabled with a rare muscle disease and fibromyalgia, is working full-time plus to keep a roof over our head and food on the table. We have medical bills, electric, phone, and all the other bills everyone else has. The difference is our medical bills include our parental fee, as well as any other services Alex or Courtney may need to help them get the tools and supports that you and I take for granted. When someone says, "Is your child on a sensory diet?" do you have any idea what that means? Or why is your child behaving like that? Doesn't he have any social skills? The answer is no. These are areas that we have to pay for things out of our pocket. Social skills are not considered medical, but our children cannot survive without it. Society wouldn't have it. As for a sensory diet, that would be a trampoline, monkey bars, fidget toys, or other equipment that helps the sensory system. This equipment is not considered medical, so we have to pay for this out of pocket too. I just got my current invoice in the mail for our TEFRA payment, and we owe the state $6,443.73 as of July of 2003. We have a payment arrangement with our financial worker because we can't pay the monthly amount the legislators have put on us. Now we are told that we are going to be put on the Minnesota Recapture Program. We are paying the most that we can each month, and yet it is not enough. So our state taxes and property taxes will be taken from us. I know you all have a lot to learn and understand, and unless you walk in our shoes or spend time with us, which you're all welcome to do at any time, you will never really understand what our lives are like. So when you have to decide whether to pay for transportation needs, education, health care, to name a few, please remember us and that you can make a difference in our lives and make it a little easier. We are counting pennies to make ends meet. We are asking you to help us bring the ends closer together. Lowering the parental fees to make to more manageable amount of what money we really live on, and maybe even consider reducing or forgiving the families who have large balances due to the 2003 increase.
Are there any questions? If not, do you have another
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC of Minnesota, and I'm here to support Senate File 1055. I do believe that you just had the fiscal note passed to you. And on that fiscal note, on the second page, I just want to point out one item. And that is as you look at it, right in the middle of the page is a paragraph that says a comparison of fee schedule billings, et cetera. And in there it says that by lowering the fee, 514 more families will access TEFRA. So the fiscal note actually, half of the reason for the fiscal note is because of the increased use of medical assistance. So we're talking in this particular bill about providing access to medical assistance for 500 more families that support their children with disabilities in their home. And so we are very pleased, and we want to thank the legislature again for the modifications that were made in the parental fee in 2005, and we hope that during this session we can continue to make progress in lowering the parental fee so those families that are supporting their children with disabilities in their home can continue to receive appropriate services. Thank you.
Any questions? If not, thank you very much.
Senator Coring? Madam Chair, if there's no further testimony or questions, I would so move that Senate File 1055 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Bill.
You've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Can you take my other one now?
Yeah, why don't we do your other one as long as you're here, Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, Senate File 1095 would require the state commissioner to establish a newborn hearing screening advisory committee and require all hospitals to have universal newborn hearing and infant screening program. And this is right now we have, I think it's 50-some test screens that we do of newborns, and that catches some 60 or so kids per year. By adding this one additional test for newborn hearing, we'd catch something like 240 additional kids. The tests make an incredible difference because if you find a child who has hearing loss early in their life, like in the first 3 months or so, and you get them help right away, which is why we have this advisory committee to make sure we set up protocols on how to screen, how to catch them, how to bring them into the system. If you give a newborn hearing assistance early on in the first 6 months of life or so, they are likely to stay with their classmates in school. They're likely not to fall behind. They're likely to be mainstream kids in every way. If you don't give them help till they're 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, they've lost the most critical years of speech and hearing participation, and it sets them back, usually permanently sets them back. It's a big savings to do this. It's a lot cheaper than special education. Minnesota does some of this screening already, but we think with this additional screening system and set up for how we're going to make sure we have a good protocol for catching all the kids, I think it'll make a tremendous difference. I have Mary Hartnett from the Council on, I always forget, Deaf and Hard.
Minnesota Commission, sir.
Commission.
We'd like to especially focus on the fiscal note,
yes,
since we don't have a lot of time today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett with the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to bring before you again the Universal Newborn Hearing Screening Bill. We are here to focus on probably subdivision 7 of the bill, which talks about the laboratory services fee. And in that, we list specifically talking about the implementing and maintaining a system to follow up on infants, to emphasize why it's important to follow up on infants. When infants are screened in the hospital, there are a number of false positives. That because they're screened doesn't mean they're caught. We talk about screening at birth and then evaluating and making sure and confirming the hearing loss by the time they're 3 months old. So I believe it's 10 to 100 babies per 1,000 do not pass the screening test, and only 3 babies per 1,000 actually have hearing loss. So we need to follow up on those 3,000 or, 10 to 100, kids per 1,000 that don't pass the test and make sure that they get that evaluation to confirm whether or not they have a hearing loss, which would result in Minnesota in about 240 kids being diagnosed with the hearing loss. That system, we also list providing technical assistance to hospitals to make sure that there's uniformity, putting a tracking system in place to make sure that the screening, referral, and diagnostic process is tracked. Data management and evaluation, all of those are listed in the bill, and that's what the fiscal note is about. I've attached in your handouts the National Center for Hearing Assessment and Management that's connected with the Centers for Disease Control. They have listed what the model programs are or protocols should be in place and what should be evaluated in a state when looking at an EHDI tracking system. And those are the elements that need to be evaluated. Particularly note Goal 6, every state will have a complete EHDI tracking and surveillance system that will minimize loss to follow-up. It lists the essential elements that need to be in place. And with that, I'll let the fiscal note be defended by the department.
Ms. Hartnett, or maybe someone from the Department of Health, do you know how much the hospital fee would be increased in order to meet this requirement?
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Christine Everson. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health Public Health Laboratory Division. We've completed the fiscal note, and it would result in a $20 increase per infant screened.
$20 increase per infant screened. Okay. Any other questions? Senator Corey.
Madam Chair, if there is no further questions on Senate File 1095, I would so move that Senate File 1095 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill.
I think that if we can just kind of hold that for a minute, our staff seems to think you have a technical amendment you need to make to the bill, Senator Marty. So maybe Mr. Gill could read that to us.
On subdivision, line 4, page 4, line 35, subdivision 8, we're supposed to delete this section and insert subdivision 2. Does Mr. Gill have? Maybe he could.
Madam Chair, that's what I understand the amendment to be. It's not in writing, but it'd be an oral amendment.
And it's, you go ahead, because you were going to put it together.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in the State and Local Government Committee, Senator Rest has a number of requirements that need to be in place for advisory councils, and she wanted to have a sunset date put in. And our understanding was it was put in that provision. We were afraid that it would interpret subdivision 8 says expiration. This section expires June 30th, 2013. We were afraid that could be construed to say newborn screening ends at that point, and so we wanted to amend it to say to delete this section on line 4.35 and say this insert subdivision 2 expires June 30th, 2013, which would, in subdivision 2, references the advisory council.
So you want to just delete the words this section and insert subdivision 2?
Right. That's correct.
Okay. So Senator Coring makes that motion for Senator Marty. Is there any discussion?
At 12:30 in the morning.
Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now Senator Coring makes the motion.
Madam Chair, I would make the motion that Senate File 1095, as amended, be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill.
Any further discussion?
Yeah.
Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Sharon, you have a bill that someone needs to testify on early in our meeting time, so why don't we take yours next?
Never said it.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Dave Giel just stepped out to copy the fiscal note on this bill, so it should be arriving in just a minute.
Well, I'm sure you have a few things to say while he's doing that, so let's go to it.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Let's go to it. My name is Kathy Sharon, and I'm here to present Senate File 1056. This is a bill that asks for appropriations to increase the number of MRRC waivers to 200. It asks for additional appropriations for family support grant programs and additional appropriations for independent living services, semi-independent learning services. Over the past five decades, Minnesota's system of support for persons with intellectual and other developmental disabilities has moved away from institutional care. So in the mid-80s, Minnesota added waivered services to the list of supports paid through medical assistance. It means the federal regulations are waived so that those resources can be used to help people stay in their homes rather than use more expensive inpatient kinds of services. So with that, I'm going to keep my comments brief because of time. And with your permission.
We appreciate that. We'd like everyone to take About 2 minutes.
And with that, I will allow others to present on this subject.
Senator Berglund and committee members, I am grateful for this opportunity to speak to you this morning. My name is Craig Johnson. I am here today in a dual role as Bishop of the Minneapolis Area Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. We number 221,000 people in the Minneapolis area in 167 congregations, which is about a quarter of the Lutheran people in the state of Minnesota. The Lutheran Church believes that to stand up for the most vulnerable in our society is a moral value of the Christian Church, which comes to us from the ministry of Jesus. I am also here as a parent that has witnessed the impact of the lack of waivered services and their benefits to disabled persons when they are restored. Our daughter was born in 1983. We knew from the first few weeks that she was struggling with eating and later with crawling and walking and talking. We worked very hard as parents. We probably overfunctioned to try and help and fix her in those early years. When she was 2.5, she was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. We immediately qualified for preschool help, and our daughter began part-day schooling at 3 years old and full-day special education at 6. She continued in special education in the Bloomington School District until she was 18 and graduated in 2004. Post-high school education was the next step for 2 years until 21. Her socialization until 21 was centered in school life as any other child, but we also supplemented that with relational programs at our church, which my wife initiated. Life was good for our daughter. Waivered services for a person with disabilities in Hennepin County stopped entrance to new clients in 2003. Laura, my daughter, was unable to gain these important funds, which would add to her ability to be a part of the community. Her mother was her best friend, and her life narrowed. From my vantage point, some of the biggest challenges persons with disabilities have is loneliness, vulnerability, and deep financial constraints because of an inability to function in a typical job. Wavered services, which now 4,200 persons are waiting to receive, help to overcome those challenges by providing personal care attendance, which enhances contact with the society, coaches to enable employment and safety because of close supervision. I worry that we will see mentally handicapped people injured because their parents will be unable to supervise them as they reach elderly and infirm levels. In 2004, I suffered a hemorrhagic stroke due to an aneurysm. That critical event in my 2.5-year recovery allowed our daughter to receive wavered services. Among the important services we were then able to have is to hire tax-paying personal care attendants that spent 3 days a week for 4 to 5 hours, which allowed my wife to work and pay taxes. Our daughter's socialization is growing and continues to grow instead of dwindling and becoming non-existent. I would urge you to find ways to fund these extraordinary important services to our most vulnerable that have such a small voice in our society. So many need your help that do not have two parents or do not have parents that can grasp and gain help from the system. As we grow older as parents, we will worry more and more about the future of our vulnerable children. Thank you.
Thank you, Bishop. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, I'm Steve Larson with the ARCA, Minnesota, and I just have a few points to make. One, that the actual number of persons being served on the developmental disabilities waiver that the Bishop was talking about has dropped from approximately 15,000 to 14,000 over the last 4 years through attrition and through this waiver program being frozen as far as new slots except for crisis services like the Bishop's family received. In addition to that, the waiting list has been reported in the last month or so to have grown to over 5,000 people. The family support grant and the semi-independent living services we're requesting increases in this particular proposal have not received increases since 1999. So we want to thank the committee for listening to our testimony on Senate File 1056, and we'd also be willing to work with the committee as necessary as we go through this process to reduce the fiscal note if possible, but hopefully to make some progress on this particular issue. Thank you very much.
Mr. Larson, do you have any ideas about how to reduce the fiscal note?
Yes, we could reduce the fiscal note by dropping the number from 200 to 100. Or we could reduce the fiscal note by looking at the number of slots that are in the forecast, which are scheduled to start on January 1st, and just moving those up to July 1st in lieu of adding additional slots. There are a number of alternatives that we could share with the committee to look at reducing the fiscal note, but making some progress on this particular issue.
Okay, well, Senator Sharon, since this is your bill, if you want to work on getting fiscal notes for those ideas, that would be helpful.
That'd be great. I'd be happy to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions or discussion? Not Senator Sharon?
I would move that we approve Senate File 1056, that it be laid over for consideration in the omnibus bill.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Senator Clark has been here. Senator Clark has been waiting. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's good to be here today.
want to acknowledge from the beginning that this is one of those opportunities that sometimes as session goes along, you find out there's something good that you could do that could make a difference that wouldn't necessarily cost a whole lot of money, but it emerges a little later in the process. So we just want to at least acknowledge that this hasn't come back before you earlier because it was not something that was ripe to be presenting. But you're grappling with many different things, particularly dealing with low-income families. And this particular proposal would utilize one-time money to be helping gain some capacity within child care, within family child care providers, and helping raise their quality. Maybe even more importantly, though, is helping connect the families that they're working with to be better utilizing services within a county. So what Senate File 1863, which hopefully you have in front of you, does,
You do have an amendment,
Senator
Clark.
I almost forgot I had an amendment, Senator Berglund.
So
I apologize.
I think it's a delete everything,
it
so
is
I think that
we, do
we
that
want
first?
That in front of the committee. So,
Madam Chair, I would so move the delete all amendment to get the bill in the shape that Senator Clark wants it in.
Senator Coring moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 1863. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now we can.
Thank you. So fairly quickly, this is a partnership between Hennepin and Ramsey Counties together with Child Care Providers Together, which is a multi-county-based organization of licensed family child care providers. The ask is for one-time funding. It'd be $75,000 in each of 2 years for Hennepin and Ramsey, so the total request is $300,000 to assist the development of an innovative provider-initiated and county-supported program. And as I said, the goals are really to try to help connect families better with county-offered services. Essentially, and I'm going to go very quick so I can have Ms. Lamp talk, it'll help leverage other public programs and dollars to benefit children and families that use child care. It'll engage the counties as key players and licensed family child care providers as key partners to support children and families, provide resources directly at the local level to improve outcomes for family child care, and contribute to stability, capacity, and quality for licensed family child care providers. And I will stop there. If it's okay, I'd like to have Ms. Lamp go ahead and talk a little bit from Hennepin County's perspective.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Kathy Lamp. I'm with Hennepin County Human Services Public Health Department and Intergovernmental Relations. I can only echo what Senator Clark has said and thanking her for bringing us to you today, and thank you for finding room for us on your agenda. This is an opportunity for us to pilot in Hennepin and Ramsey strategies that we think could be effective strongly support connect the county programs and through outreach to the family child care providers. We think they could. This is probably makes a lot of sense. We could or should have been able to do it earlier, but to be able to reach out to and use 1,200. Approximately 1,200 licensed family providers in Hennepin County, another 800 in Ramsey County, to be able to use them as outreach, to strengthen them as providers, but to reach out to their families and communities. We think that this, that piloting some of these strategies will be beneficial for us, but also we could then go statewide.
And is part of the idea trying to help these providers inform their parents about how to apply, for instance, for medical assistance programs, to make
absolutely
sure their children are insured? And
absolutely, that is our goal, to be able to to use families like as a hub in a way, to help us to reach out into their families, into their communities with our programs, the public programs, healthcare programs, healthcare for children, but public health and other community programs.
If a child
that we know
has
they're
some
eligible
kind of
for
a learning disability, getting them hooked
getting back
up
into the
early
county. Again, we're trying to improve our capacity to be a front door to our county programs.
And Madam Chair, I think along with that, what is also an exciting possibility is we have so many providers that are more in the family friend and neighbor kind of situation. If they see the opportunities being part of, if you're licensed and ways to be helping the families more, they would see licensure as more of a benefit than sometimes they do right now. But just even thinking about the public health opportunities with connecting these children with public health could really be a real step forward. So I think if we were able to test this and help kind of incubate it a bit, its strategies could be used around the state.
Are there any questions? Senator Pretner Solon?
Madam Chair, if you're ready, I would move that Senate File 1863 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Senator Pretner Solon. Is there any discussion of the motion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, why don't we do 971 first?
Okay.
And there is an amendment that Ms. Kavanaugh prepared for this. And while it's being handed out, maybe she can explain how she was able to make this revenue neutral.
Madam Chair, the changes are that we limited to single-source drugs where there are 2% of the fee-for-service medical assistance recipients have used that drug. When that drug is removed from the formulary due to the fact that the manufacturer doesn't sign the rebate, the commissioner then gets a notification from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that agreement was not signed. At that time, the commissioner is required to provide a notification to the prescribing practitioners within 30 days.
Okay, so this is a delete everything amendment, and Senator Lori, would you like to move the amendment for Senator Higgins? He will.
So moved.
Is there any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. And I think Ms. Kavanaugh pretty much just explained the amendment. And you're telling me now that with this amendment, the bill has no fiscal impact?
According to Ms. Kavanaugh, yes, that's correct.
Okay. So do you want to have some testimony on your bill?
I think Mr. Wilson can give you a good reason to do this bill, and he can do it in about 30 seconds. So
that would be great.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. Will Wilson from the Mental Health Association. If a patient who is taking a mental health drug is no longer has access to that drug, it can be incredibly disruptive to their lives. And we are here to speak in favor of Senate File 971 to try and give as much notice to medical professionals so that they can begin a transition plan from one drug to another to be have as little disruption as possible to patients on mental health drugs. So we're here to support the bill. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. I don't see any. Anyone else to testify?
That's it.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if there's no further questions, I would so move that. Are we going to lay this over for the...
No, this can go on to the full Finance Committee
okay.
now.
Madam Chair, I would so move then that Senate File 971, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Okay, Senator Higgins, you want to take Senate File 570 next?
Yes, please. And I have a handout. In support of this. Come on up, Mike.
That's right.
And somehow I don't seem to have a fiscal note, so...
I think could someone bring it to her? We do have one.
Okay. Madam Chair, we finally got the... Okay, I suppose I should start and tell you what this bill does. I'm sorry. Those of you who sit on the Health Care Policy Committee heard... compelling testimony about the problems that we have with the broker service for transportation for non-emergency medical reasons. We heard stories about how people in emergency rooms call to have a patient transported back home, and you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours later, there's nobody there, and then when they do show up, they don't have the right equipment to get the person home, and the issues have just gone on and on and on. So we finally got the fiscal note, and Mr. Wiedner from the association, I think, has a couple of suggestions. He's been talking to the department, and we think there are a couple of suggestions to get the cost down to almost nothing. So if I could have him walk through that, I think that you'd be pleased to figure that piece of it out.
Welcome to our committee.
Yeah, go ahead and go through all the changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for the time today. We received the fiscal note on House file.
You could just state your name for the record.
I'm sorry. Michael Widener. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Paratransit Providers Association and a member of the Minnesota Medical Transportation Coalition, which is a coalition of numerous groups, including the Minnesota Ambulance Association, EMS Association, Paramedic Association, STS Association, and we've all come together on this matter. Madam Chair, we have had a chance to look at the fiscal note that was provided by the department today, and we believe that a couple of changes to the bill directly can help reduce the cost of this fiscal note and eventually get it to revenue neutral. Those would be the changes that are suggested would be on line 2.15.
Page 2.
On 2.15, after the word physician, include a licensed practical nurse. Then on line 220 and 222, replace the word skilled with licensed. And then on page 3.1, change that word, change skilled there also to licensed. And then on page 3.17, currently we're seeking a rate increase of $1.85 per mile. And if we reduce that to $1.60 per mile, I think that'll save about $700,000 a year. So in addition, Senator Berglund, I think there were some savings that were supposed to occur that were not included in the fiscal note. And those savings would include, by expanding the mileage, the computerized quickest mileage statewide, there would also be a savings, which is not included or contemplated in the fiscal note. Also, by removing the capitated rate that the broker receives, the broker currently uses that money to pay providers and then retains a percentage of the profit. There's in the fiscal note itself, there's no contemplation as to the savings to the state for not paying that profit, and we believe that that also will produce savings to the state. And then lastly, Senator, the bill also requires or prohibits the broker from doing level of need assessments more than twice a year. Currently, the broker is doing level of need assessments 3 to 4 times a year. That savings should also be included in the fiscal note, and we think in combination, all of those things will make this revenue neutral.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, I would like to make a motion, oral motion, if it's okay with Senator Higgins. And what Mr. Widener was saying, and now I don't know if I heard him correctly, so help me out here. Line 215, after physician, you were proposing what, Mr. Widener?
A licensed practical nurse.
Licensed practical nurse. I would include that in my motion. And then, Madam Chair, and then on line 220.
Senator Coring, do you want to move the motion that they said?
I would move that motion.
Why don't we just have the staff?
The only thing is, Madam Chair, is I'm wondering, did Mr. Widener say on line 2.22, it says skilled care nursing. Did you say that too?
Pardon? Yes, he did.
Yeah, it should be licensed.
So there's actually three skilled changes to licensed,
yes.
Right? Okay. I would, Madam Chair, I would so move those changes along with, I think it was it line 317 to change it from 185 to 165?
Yes.
There are other changes, too.
Pardon?
So let's
other
just
changes too.
Let's just ask the staff to read back the amendment as they understand it.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, on page 2, line 15, after physician, comma, inserts a licensed practical nurse, comma. On page 2, line 20, delete skilled and insert licensed. Page 2, line 22, delete skilled care and insert licensed. Page 3, line 1, delete skilled and insert licensed. Page 3, line 17, delete $1.85 and insert $1.60.
No, I think it was 65. No,
60.
60. 60, okay.
Okay, so Senator Coring makes that motion for Senator Higgins. Is there any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I believe the department told Mr. Widener that those changes...
No, the department didn't.
Oh, not the department. Okay.
In reviewing the fiscal note.
Yep.
So we will have to request a revised fiscal note based on the amendment. We will do that.
And maybe, I don't know if there's some way to remind them to look at the other issues that Mr. Widener called out.
Yes, we will do that.
Okay.
Any questions, Senator Prettner-Solon?
So, Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I've got this correct, Mr. Widener. You're keeping the contractor in place but limiting some of their activities. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator, okay. Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Okay. Senator Prettner-Solon, do you want to make the motion?
Certainly. Madam Chair, I recommend that, or I move that Senate File 570, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
Senator Erickson Ropes, you have a witness that needs to leave fairly early this morning, so why don't we take you next?
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm here today with Senate File 1891, and this came to me late, but I think it also gives us a great opportunity to provide a little lab out there that will deal with universal health care or a method for getting us to universal health care. It comes from a community who's very interested in helping the state move to universal health care. We could provide some a lot of data, baseline information, and they're just really willing to go on this. Basically, what we'd be doing is providing, if you'll see the fiscal note, you see that it comes in under $100,000.
I don't know if we don't have fiscal notes.
Okay.
I thought it was in our packets.
At the first, the first or second one.
It's just one page.
Just at the end.
And it's a small fiscal note.
Yes, very small. So I'm happy to put this before you. But there's a lot of energy around this idea, and basically we would be asking the Commissioner of Human Services to provide a grant to a community, and we could do an RFP if that's the way we decide to go. The community partnership would involve at least one county, one local hospital, one employer that has at least 300 jobs in the community, one school system, a group of physicians, clinics, third-party payer, which may include a county-based purchasing plan or a self-insured employer. All these people come together and design, if you look on page 2.12, there are the proposal requirements. So we're setting before them all the things that we've been talking about all session long, about a method of insuring the uninsured and underinsured, a method for coordinating services between the providers and agencies. And I think what's most essential here, if you look at number 5, it says a method for comparing the actual costs of serving the uninsured and underinsured persons compared to the predicted costs of what it would have cost the state and public programs if these people had not had their services and health care taken care of. So I think it's a great program. It could be a little lab for us. And Dr. Deichel is here. He's been working with the fellow who brought this proposal to me. They're from southwestern Minnesota. And interestingly enough, I will say that the fellow who brought the program to me is Frank Schuffelbein, who some of our conservative friends may know. He's a very wealthy cattleman from southern Minnesota, and is absolutely convinced that the state needs to get to universal health care because we need to keep people healthy so they're employable. It's not good for businesses. It's the right thing to do for people, but he's really making the economic argument for getting to universal health care, and he's very excited about it. And I'm thrilled that he's out there marketing this to our conservative friends. So, Dr. Deichel, would you like to provide some testimony to the committee?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am honored to be able to present today. My name is Will Deichel. I'm an independent consulting psychiatrist and healthcare consultant and have spent the last 20 years consulting on a local and national level to all the different systems that serve individuals with mental health and chemical health problems, including the correction system, the social service system, public health system, mental health, and special education. And the costs in these systems are often phenomenal, often because costs are shifted to these systems from the health insurance companies when they don't provide the services that are necessary. Minnesota has the potential to lead the country in health care reform with the goal of providing universal health care coverage to all of our citizens. However, using hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars to retrofit the present health insurance system to cover the uninsured is not a reasonable option. This bill provides an integrated service model that eliminates the flaws of the present system, such as high administrative costs, fragmented services, and cost shifting to the public sector systems such as social services, corrections, public health, and education. Its inherent design encourages early intervention and prevention activities, coordination between medical and mental health services, and the recognition of the hidden costs to public sector systems that are incurred when clients have unrecognized and untreated physical and mental illness. It benefits employees and employers by encouraging early treatment of disorders in workers and their children, thus decreasing absenteeism. The bill eliminates school districts' fears of identifying students' mental health disorders because districts are the payer of last resort for treatment of uninsured students in special education. It provides a health care home for everyone and ensures consistent and continuous treatment for persons with chronic illnesses, even during periods when they are uninsured. There are numerous proposals being discussed at this time that address health care for the uninsured, and all of these have merit. I believe that this bill provides an ideal method of addressing this issue, as it not only provides health care coverage, but also provides an integrated, cost-effective, and evidence-based paradigm of service delivery that can seamlessly expand to eventually potentially cover all individuals in its geographic area who presently have public or private health insurance coverage. Doing it right somewhere small and providing a thorough outcome analysis of the positive impact of these interventions on the business community and the public sector systems will provide a foundation for expansion to universal coverage for all Minnesotans. This model will provide a thorough evaluation of the impact to a community when integrated services are provided to the uninsured. It will quantify both the costs and the savings benefits of eliminating uncompensated care in hospitals and emergency rooms, of preventing the deterioration of chronic medical and mental health disorders, and the impact of employability when uninsured individuals receive the treatment that they require. This information will be very valuable as future decisions are made to expand coverage to all Minnesotans. By reducing overhead expenses, encouraging collaboration and integration, and focusing on best practices interventions, this model will provide the most cost-effective and clinically effective service delivery system. Minnesotans will have the opportunity to have both universal coverage as well as a healthcare delivery system that is efficient, accountable, and focused first and foremost on patient needs. I can talk about costs in answering questions.
Well, I think I have a few questions about the fiscal note. I think the fiscal note only really has the administrative costs of evaluating and providing the grants. And so there's nothing in this fiscal note about how much the grants would be.
Right.
And maybe you can give us some clue about what you thought that part of the
thinking
bill
this was. Through in terms of the political climate, the funds available, money is tight, I believe that one option would be to utilize a phased approach, requesting $300,000 for administrative funds in the grant for comprehensive project planning and development this year. The authors can work with legislative staff to draft alternative language so that the bill can be changed in order to implement the pilot project in two phases. In the first phase, DHS will award grants for planning and development in 2007, which will be used to further define the projects and develop more detailed enabling legislation. The second phase could involve legislative authorization for operational funds in 2008 that will allow the projects to move forward.
And in 2008, what were you thinking the operational grants would need to have for funding?
It depends on the design of the program, how many communities are identified, what is covered, and whether there would be coverage for all disorders or limited disorders.
So you're thinking that the planning money would come first and then there'd be a determination later about funding the operational grants?
I think the best approach realistically would be to thoroughly design the plan and create a blueprint that would cover all the bases so that we can roll into 2008 funding with operational funds that would be appropriate for a model of services that would be most effective. It's difficult to identify the specific costs at this point because of the this is written broadly enough to be able to cover lots of different contingencies.
Well, I think my problem is that if we're appropriating money to be spent in 2008, I would need to know how much we're appropriating. I can't, you know, the other way would be just to fund planning grants and then evaluate the plans and, you know, decide whether we could fund them at a future time.
If the ideal is to have universal coverage for all Minnesotans and to cover all Minnesotans who are now uninsured, the fiscal note on that is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So the question at this point would be, if you do a pilot program as a demonstration project, you have to start large enough to be able to create meaningful data and have a large enough group of people that can then be analyzed for the outcome analysis. To give you a specific cost, it really depends on the population that is chosen, the mental health and medical problems that are identified, and whether there were situations where if someone needed a kidney transplant, they could bankrupt the entire program, whether there would be a backup through other state funds.
Okay, so we don't know what we would be looking at for phase two.
That would what phase one would be to help identify the specific costs. But it would be, conservatively, for a small community, it would be several hundred thousand dollars to do it correctly with a limited group of illnesses. And in terms of a larger community or three communities, I would expect that that would be in the low single-figure millions of dollars to really do it thoroughly. It's hard to be more specific because we don't have the specifics as what will be covered at this point and what the catchment area, how large it would be, one county, et cetera. I can give you an example, though. I consult to a county-based purchasing organization in western Minnesota that covers 10 counties, and they are already initiating public health services whereby if someone is a child protection parent, they are getting screened for mental health disorders to assure that they don't have an unidentified depression that would cause them to neglect their children and have them removed. Or if someone has a chemical dependency problem, they're also identified to assure they don't have bipolar disorder, which might be why they are using heavily, because there's a 70% overlap between those disorders. And because it's county-based purchasing, there's no incentive for the county to cost shift to itself, as is often done by healthcare companies. And so this model may cost more for the health plan, but ultimately it may cost significantly less for the counties due to cost savings in social services, corrections, public health, and education.
A lot of what we're talking about with reforming the mental health system with the mental health bill. other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Deichel, do you have some partnerships already in place? Are there going to be some communities that will be willing to accept their participation in this?
The communities in western Minnesota and the Prime West area are very interested in this, and they are very interested in moving forward to cover. They're already covering some of the uninsured for crisis situations, but they're very interested in expanding, and that's 10 counties in western Minnesota.
Madam Chair, I know you made reference to that earlier, but that will be the test area is in western Minnesota, or have you taken this any further to other areas? Or
not necessarily. also in southern Minnesota, there's South Country's Health Plan, another county-based purchasing. There are other communities that are also interested in moving forward in this direction.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it would be a competitive grant process.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay. Well, I think at a minimum we need to add $300,000 to the fiscal note here for the amount that would be needed for the planning grants. So we can just pencil that into this fiscal note. Senator, do you have a motion?
Thank you. I would like to move Senate File 18-921 recommend it to pass and be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Next, we're going to go to Senate File 1961, Item 7 on the agenda, Care Coordination System for Children with High-Cost Medical Conditions. Senator Berglund.
We have a handout for the committee on this bill. Madam Chair and members of the division, this is a project that has been started by the state of Minnesota. It's a project that coordinates with the University of Minnesota, and it serves children with very high medical needs, children at very great risk of hospitalization. And it started out in the metropolitan area. And last biennium, we gave them some money so they could expand into two areas, was it?
We were hoping to expand more to rural Minnesota.
Yeah. Anyway, their expansion was into more of the rural parts of the state, and this bill would allow them to expand further in terms of serving more parents. They do a lot of phone triage with parents in terms of helping the parents understand what to do when their child is in a crisis to help that child remain stable and remain out of the hospital and remain at home. Over the years, we found that the cost of doing this is offset by the savings of reduced hospitalizations. And so I'd like to introduce Dr. Ann Kelly to tell you more about the program.
Dr. Kelly, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Ann Kelly. I'm a pediatrician at the University of Minnesota, and I'm the director of the Youth Special Kids Program. And thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund. I began this program about 10 years ago to address the needs of children who were frequently hospitalized, who had very complicated medical conditions, and who tended to be difficult to both discharge from the hospital and to maintain in the community, many of the children being from rural communities around Minnesota. I started this program with a grant and then eventually worked up towards legislative funding for the last 5 years to support this program. We are a small team, myself and two nurses, one nurse practitioner, who provide intensive case management to children with very high-cost conditions from around the state. And I think, maybe as you heard of some of the testimony before us, it's one or two children that can consume vast amounts of resources from one community that could bankrupt a system. And those are the children that we target for case management. Our hope is that we can control those costs, reduce their hospitalizations, improve the outcomes of those children so they spend less time in the hospital and more time at home. But the cost savings benefit not only the families, but the state and the health plans as well. So over the last 10 years, I think we've learned a great deal about how to do this better, how to do this in more remote communities, how to manage children in rural outstate locations using more telemedicine sort of technology, and I think actually providing more of a comprehensive approach to this group of children, which includes dealing with their physical conditions, their mental health conditions, and their community resource needs.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Berglund.
Do I have an amendment for this?
The funds for this expansion of the Youth Special Kids Program include a 24-hour advanced practice nurse triage line that I think could help tremendously in reducing emergency room utilization. I'd also originally asked for funding for a website where we could keep summaries of critical information for the nurses to use after hours, but I've actually found private funding for the website, so if we could amend that from this bill.
And I think that's found on page 3, subdivision 7. So it's lines 3.6 through 3.17.
So just take it out?
And so I think we can just move to delete that section.
Yes. Senator Berglund has an amendment to remove lines 3.6 to 3.17. Is there any discussion? On Senator Berglund's amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 It's not on the amendment. It wasn't on the amendment. Okay. Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Then perhaps, Dr. Kelly, you could tell us how much that would reduce the request for the appropriations.
Dr. Kelly.
It would reduce the request by $500,000.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Kelly and Senator Berglund, my understanding is we pay managed health care to do this function, that part of what their contract is when we contract with the managed health care plan is to do care coordination and to try to do the same things that we're now, you know, that this seems to be another layer of coordination. And so I guess I'm just wondering, what does this service do that the health plan isn't already responsible for doing?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, these children would probably not be in a health care plan because they are so disabled. They have multiple disabilities, so they would fall into that part of our population that would be in the fee-for-service system. And so there's no care coordination in that part of the system.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, okay, thanks. That really helps to explain this for me. And do you have an idea how many children are served in a year with this program?
Dr. Kelly.
We have an active caseload right now of about 50 children.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I'm on another subject. I'm wondering if Senator Berglund also wants to delete 4.1 to 4.3 then.
Yes. I would make that motion.
All right. Senator Berglund has an oral amendment to delete lines 4.1 through 4.3. Is there any discussion? Senator
That's fine. We took it up.
Okay. On the amendment to delete 4.1 to 4.3, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment's adopted. Thank you. Senator Manager, Rosen.
However, on our last amendment, I guess my question is the database or the website going to be still within the Department of Human Services?
No.
Dr. Kelly.
No, we would develop that at the University of Minnesota.
There are other questions from the committee. Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair, then I would move that Senate File 1961 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Berglund. Should we move on to Senate File 1962?
Yes, please.
The Waseca County Nursing Facility. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this is a proposal that would provide a coordination of care between the Mayo Clinic, a nursing home in Waseca, and the providers in southern Minnesota. It would be a project for ventilator-dependent patients. These patients oftentimes end up being hospitalized frequently over and over again because their inability to remain stable. And this is a unique project that's been operating in Wisconsin that has found that they're able to get many of these ventilator-dependent patients back home in the community, and in other cases, keep them from being rehospitalized by providing them specialized nursing home care where they have staff that are specially trained, nurses that are specially trained in how to provide cares for ventilator-dependent patients. I do have an A1 amendment for this bill.
I think the A1 amendment has been distributed. Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye. I'm sorry. Senator Sharon.
Senator Prettner-Solon, I'm looking for
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, please explain the change in that this amendment makes.
Senator Berglund, the A1 amendment.
Well, it's really a technical amendment. The nursing home is looking for a change in reimbursement in order to pay for the higher cost services of providing staff that are trained in ventilator cares. And so this is an amendment that has been suggested by the department to make it conform better with the way ventilator-dependent care is paid for.
So,
Senator Prentner,
Madam Chair, and Senator Berglund, conceivably it could be more than 300% of the Group 3 rate, RUG rate then. Is that correct? No?
Senator Berglund. I think there's someone from the department, maybe.
And I might just say this is an author's amendment. This is the first time this bill's been heard.
Okay, so I'm sorry.
If you don't mind putting it on the bill, and then we'll explain it.
That's fine with me.
All right, Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund.
I'd like to ask Mr. Medell to testify on the bill, and I'd also just like to call to your attention a letter and an article about a ventilator-dependent patient that was in the that appeared in regard to someone with ALS. This is the type of person that this project would be serving.
Mr. Madej, welcome to the committee.
Okay. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Maddle, Jr. I'm CEO of Lakeshore Inn, skilled nursing facility in Waseca, Minnesota. We also offer senior housing with services in an attached building. I'm here to support and respond to questions regarding this Senate File 1962. This would set our rate for ventilator-dependent patients at the statutory maximum in our rural area. I emphasize rural because that still, in answer to your question, ma'am, that would put our rate still slightly below, I know, the rate at Bethel, which has probably one of the best, if not the best, vent units in Minnesota right now. Several months ago, doctors from Mayo Health Systems asked us to institute a unit for ventilator-dependent patients. Dr. Mark Lindsay, a Mayo pulmonologist, whom Senator Berglund has met a couple of times, has developed a protocol for such patients featuring an emphasis on weaning, on actually liberating patients from their ventilators. Dr. Lindsay, who is also chief quality officer for Mayo Health Systems, has been using this protocol for several years at a nursing home in Eau Claire, where Mayo has a strong presence. His results have been nothing short of phenomenal. According to published literature, the nursing home for which he is medical director has experienced successful weaning in over 60% of their patients by following this protocol. Those 60% of patients that normally we would expect, once you go in a nursing home, you know, the old rule is if you leave horizontal. These people are walking out the door. Comparable nursing homes, ones that have made an effort at weaning, experience from 15% to a high of 38 compared to his actually 67%. If we proceed with this, with your help, Dr. Lindsay will be our medical director. The problem we bring to you is that the new employees we will need, experienced nurses and respiratory therapists, nurses who've worked in the pulmonary areas, will have to be found through Mayo job posting. And Mayo has agreed to do that, that we'll be able to go on their job posting line. They will expect, however, Mayo-level salaries. Mayo salaries, of necessity, are comparable to Minneapolis and St. Paul. It would be operationally impossible for us to be paying a new nurse on the vent unit substantially more than a nurse who has been with us for over 20 years. The bill in front of you will permit us to equalize our salaries throughout the building. Please understand This is not a request for you to subsidize our losses that we have incurred through poor management. We do not have losses, and we manage very well, thank you. We do not provide the level of care we did 10 years ago. I think all of you are quite aware of that. I might mention just for one comment on that, the change in the quality of our care is that if we go in to turn a patient to prevent bed sores, decubiti, we used to be able to go in and kind of speak to the patient a little bit and then be continuing to speak to them as we're turning them and speak to them again as we're leaving. Now we get the heck in there, turn them, and get out because we've got a lot of other work to do. Our staffing has been cut every time we don't get adequate inflation money. Only one place we can cut. That's in staff, and we don't have as much as we did. But the bill in front of you would permit us to equalize them. I might also mention that the under the heading of we don't have losses, my son Pete is the administrator now. I was administrator from the time we opened till 96. He has been there since then. He has management contracts with two other nursing homes. Both of those nursing homes were losing substantial money when Pete came in. Both of them are in the black now with the cash flow. So we know what we're doing. This bill simply permits us to institute a unit the likes of which does not exist in the state of Minnesota. Financially, every time we could liberate a patient from a ventilator, it would save over $200,000 a year. That's what it costs to keep a patient in a nursing home, average, about $200,000 a year. So every time we can take one off and liberate them, that's a savings of $200,000 a year. More important, every time it happened, a human being could go home. Madam Chair, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, I support your bill. I understand the need for it, and but I would also like to put in a plea for rebasing rather than having so many nursing homes come before us because the industry has gone through such a change and so many have changed the direction of their nursing care. And rebasing hasn't been done for over a dozen years. I think that we do need to do something to bring them up to the level of rates that they need in order to sustain themselves.
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solon, I don't disagree with you. It's just a matter of money.
I know.
There's quite a few things that this committee should do that are difficult because of the restrictions we have regarding our funds that are available to us. But and this, of course, isn't going to serve my district or probably my constituents. We do have ventilator-dependent nursing home units up in the Twin Cities area. They are not especially geared toward this program of weaning. And so it did seem to me when this opportunity came our way that we should take a look at it. And rebasing would not solve this problem because this would be an entirely new service that can't even get started if there's not some kind of a rate change for the facility.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, I would also just like to echo Senator Prettner-Solon's comments. As I know you are aware and I'm sure concerned about, we have a lot of existing nursing homes around the state that are also losing money, and a system of payment for nursing homes that hasn't been updated and has resulted in some nursing homes geographically that's really hard to understand why one in a certain area would be paid more than one in another area in terms of their actual costs. So I know that we're contemplating what we can do for nursing homes across the board this year, but as we have looked at with other bills, there are some nursing homes whose needs are are greater in the terms of the immediate threat to them closing their doors is greater. And so as we look at where we're going to put the dollars for nursing homes, I would just also really encourage this committee to look at where they're the most desperately needed.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, this does affect my constituents, and I do thank you for taking this bill because I do serve Waseca County. I'm not Senator for Waseca. So I thank you, Senator Berglund, for being receptive to these type of bills and understanding that the nursing homes that are profitable are usually the ones that have developed some kind of niche market. I hate to make that sound so insensitive, but either it's Alzheimer's unit or something on this line. So not to rehash what we've been talking about, but it is interesting trend to see out in greater Minnesota what these nursing homes are doing to serve the aging population, their people, but it's also to see as a business how they've had to be a little more creative. So thank you for taking this bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Senator Rosen, of course, if this did get started, then I believe it would have the impact of changing the way the other ventilator homes that we have operate, because obviously when somebody's doing something a little better, you want to get better too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think bringing this model that's been successful in Wisconsin to Minnesota will have kind of a broad impact of improving people's lives and reducing costs.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I appreciate when there's a cost savings why this would be a good program. And again, I'm certainly not opposed to this bill. I would just like to comment that some areas, especially in northern Minnesota, where we're not as geographically close to some areas in the metro where there might be able to, or to the Mayo Clinic where there's an opportunity for partnerships, that the idea of filling a particular niche market is really not as realistic. And yet there's a real need for nursing homes. The loss of one nursing home doesn't mean often that there's another alternative. There just won't be a nursing home in the community any longer if it has to close its doors. So I guess that's just the only point I wanted to make.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to speak in support of this bill. I know, as I was on the board of the Mayo Health System, I know about this initiative in our area, southern Minnesota, and I think it does provide just exactly what Senator Berglund is talking about and why we're supportive of it. It gives us an opportunity to take a look at how a particular approach to ventilator care can create a different outcome, a cost saving, and a quality of life for people. So I'm very supportive of this and hoping that it does prove to create a solution for us throughout the state.
Senator Berglund.
If I may, Senator Berglund's point about it changing throughout the state, Dr. Lindsay is already looking at that and has contacted a pulmonologist friend of his in the metropolitan area that he's kind of told, I want you to be working with me on this so that we can bring this up to Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Thank you. Senator Berglund.
If there are no further questions, then, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 1962, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Berglund. We'll move on to Senate File 842, Fee for Service Inpatient Care Changes for GMAC.
Right. Madam Senator Chair and members of the committee, you might remember this was a bill that we've already heard and sent out of this committee. And just shortly before it was going to be heard in the full finance committee, we got a fiscal note from the department that indicated that, first of all, the bill didn't need to be passed by April 1st. So I guess that was a bit of good news because it was going to be kind of interesting to see if we could actually accomplish that. And secondly, the fiscal note had some savings, which was also good news. So at this time, Madam Chair, get this bill back before us, I'd like to move to reconsider the motion whereby Senate File 842, as amended, was recommended to pass.
And Senator Berglund's motion. All those in favor say aye.
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 So
motion's adopted. Senator Coring.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, so what does that mean? So this was laid on the table for possible inclusion. Now we're taking it off the table? Or
no, Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, this was passed to the full Finance Committee.
Okay, so we're pulling
so
it back.
So we've just taken that action back.
Okay.
So now the bill is back before us.
Okay.
And my intention would be to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, since it doesn't have to pass by April 1st, and since it has somewhat of a small savings, that we could capture that savings in the omnibus bill.
The questions from members of the committee. Senator
Bergen. I'm not going to, you know, re-explain the basic bill since we did have testimony on it. It's about capturing the DISH money. I do have an A3 amendment that I'd like to consider to the bill.
Is the A3 amendment being distributed or it's being passed out? Senator Berglund, would you like to, while it's being distributed, begin telling us about the A3 amendment?
The A3 amendment deals with the way in which we distribute funds for medical education. And we've heard earlier in the year from the department that they have heard from the federal government that part of our funding for our Merck formula is being challenged by the federal government because it's not based on the provider being or having medical assistance patients. And almost all of our Merck money now is a carve-out from our medical assistance payments. So in other words, these were payments that used to go out to hospitals, and we carved them out and earmarked them for the purposes of medical education so that we could distribute them and target them more to the places that were doing medical education. Any hospital that's doing medical education and has medical assistance clients in any numbers has sort of two disadvantages in terms of their competitiveness in the marketplace. A, medical education costs you money to do it. And B, if you have medical assistance clients, you're not generally getting paid what you might be getting paid for commercial clients in your hospital. And so this would take most of the medical education money and have it flow to hospitals more based on their participation in the medical assistance program. The amendment would make sure that the University of Minnesota is held harmless. The amendment would provide $1 million in funding for systems that otherwise would lose money under a change that's proposed. Well, the federal government is challenging part of our Merck payments at the present time. We have every reason to believe that they're going to challenge the rest of it next year. And so it seems to me like it would be better just to make the corrections that we need to in our Merck formula at one time and to do it at this time. There is a handout that would show you what the amendment would do in terms of redistribution of dollars to the various hospitals that receive funding today. And
that handout's being distributed.
Some of the hospitals that have been here this year testifying about their financial distress, like our children's hospitals and others, Gillette, are going to benefit by the change that would be made in this amendment.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, I missed the part where we are reconsidering a DISH payment and then transfer and then replacing it with the Merck payment. And I'm wondering, are we still not trying to recapture the DISH funds also?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solon, we're not changing the base bill that we had about DISH.
We're adding to it?
We're adding to it.
Okay. So we're not replacing DISH funds with Merck funds?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
To be sure that we're clear about what we're doing here, what really is happening is a result of the change of policy at the federal level that wants these dollars to be following the patients served rather than the students who are being educated.
Yes.
And that's the essential policy change.
Yes. And Madam Chair and Senator Sharon,
Berger.
The reason for that is because this is a Medicaid program. We do get Medicaid matching dollars for this.
And
Senator Sharon.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Senator Berglund, further, it is your goal to not leave any federal dollars on the table, if it's possible, in terms of redirecting this money in a way that allows us to draw federal dollars for serving our needy population. That is your goal.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, yes, I don't want to lose the federal dollars, because the hospitals that will lose those dollars are the ones that need them the most. And we don't have enough money, in my opinion, to provide for all of the needs that the hospitals have that have been hit the hardest by the cuts that we've made to hospitals over the last 5 years.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Senator Berglund, this is helping us to capture the maximum amount of federal dollars?
Senator Berglund. Chair and Senator Prettner-Solon, yes.
Senator Sharon.
So the hole that is made by this, the gap that's going to occur as a result of this, primarily hurts those institutions who are very committed to creating medical resources to us in psychiatry and all of the medical education systems, such as the Mayo Clinic, is probably the system that is most impacted by this in terms of loss of revenue. But in your bill, you allow for about $1 million to for an interim kind of support system. Can you tell me what the loss is for them in terms of what they will have to make up for medical education? Because, Madam Chair, there is a significant cost to these institutions who are taking on for the general public the responsibility of providing future physicians. And
so
the state has an interest in supporting medical education.
Senator Berglund.
You would look at this handout, and if you'll go down the list, and if you'll look at the Mayo Clinic, you'll see the number that's in parentheses, and that would be the loss that they would be experiencing.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Corn.
And Madam Chair, if you would also look at, I believe St. Mary's Hospital is the Mayo Clinic, too, so you can combine those two together.
Senator Coring, on your point, Rochester Methodist Hospital as well.
Yes.
The next page.
It would be those three on
Senator
the
Berglund.
First page.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, so this is kind of based on the more medical MA that a hospital accepts, if they accept a lot of MA, then they're going to come out on the winning end of this, and if they don't, they're not. Is that kind of
Madam Chair and Senator,
Senator Berglund.
That's right.
Okay.
And the reason is because these are medical assistance dollars that we're that we've got in here. When we went through the 2003 cuts, we had general fund dollars that got cut out of the Merck appropriation.
Senator Sharon.
I just am concerned that this is a very big change for medical education at the Mayo Health System, and that $1 million does not really create. And I'm wondering if there's an alternative that we have in terms of dollars that might be available to us as we argue about where this should be funded that would not compromise what it is that you're trying to accomplish in terms of getting as many dollars from matched from the federal government.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, the only other thing we could do, I mean, the department, the governor's budget has $16 million, but, of course, it comes out of the Health Care Access Fund, which, you know, is sort of a sensitive issue as to how we spend that money. The other thing would be to find some more general fund money that could be put into this that wouldn't need medical assistance match.
Senator Sharon.
Oh, go ahead. Were you going to speak?
Could you see me raise my hand? And then I'm realizing I'm the chair.
I'll call on you. Yes.
You could. But if I, if you would just allow me, okay. 2 points. One being that just for the conversation, I guess I did introduce a bill that. Has not had an opportunity to be heard, but seeks to support the governor's initiative as related to Merck funds on the one hand, but alternatively seeks to fund that proposal out of the general fund as opposed to the Health Care Access Fund. So I just throw that out there as a possible alternative. But Senator Berglund, I wonder if you could help me to further understand on lines 4.26, it appears that there are two institutions that have been noted to receive medical education funds. And it sort of caught my eye because it is certainly no secret to members of the committee that this amendment would cause me great concern and distress. So, why those two institutions?
4.26. Madam Chair,
Senator
and members of the committee, when the change, when the reduction in Merck funds were made in 2003, there was a certain portion of the cigarette tax money that was earmarked for the University of Minnesota. And some of that money was getting federal match and some of it wasn't. So this would just allow that money to continue to go to the University of Minnesota.
What about Fairview?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, was there any other money earmarked with respect to what you were just talking about for any other institutions
no.
or just for those two?
Just
Senator
the Berglund. University.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, that explains the University of Minnesota at the School of Dentistry, but what about the on line, page 4, line 0.28?
Senator Berglund.
Fairview University Medical Center. I did not know that that was a partnership with the university.
Yes,
Senator
it
Berglund.
Is. Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, Fairview University Medical Center is owned by the University of Minnesota, and so they receive their Merck dollars through the University of Minnesota.
There are questions from members of the committee. Senator Sharon.
I just before voting for this, I'd like to know, Madam Chair, the proposal that you're talking about in terms of at least on a short-term interim basis, finding money in the general fund or funding through the other option is through the Access Fund, Minnesota Care Access Fund. If we could proceed with an amendment of that sort to this bill to allow for that to happen until we resolve a better long-term solution. Because I support the overall objective that you're trying to accomplish, Senator Berglund, but I think that we need to not have a shockwave run through another system in order to accomplish that. So I'm wondering if we can find some accommodation or make a recommendation for accommodation.
Senator.
There are those on this committee that know far better how to accomplish that than I do, but...
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, the best way, I think, would be if you want to increase the amount on line 8.7 in the bill.
It's from the, and so from the general fund.
Senator Sharon.
I would be willing to do that. I'm looking to you, Senator Lynch, in terms of a number, since you have been in communication with this male clinic is in your district. Is there a number that you might recommend?
Well, I would just offer that, just doing the simple math, it looks that I'm exceeding $10 million. And so $1 million is well short of $10 million. And on your point, Senator Sharon, while I appreciate your desire to make some accommodation here, I would suggest that rather than making accommodation for a particular entity, that it, at least in my mind, might be more favorable to do something that is a compromise for those Merck dollars. Senator Berglund has, to this date, clearly identified for us that the federal allocation is causing us to look at this in a different light. And there are those that are of the opinion that, you know, maybe we should just take a stronger leap and just, you know, go forth with all of the MA support. But I guess I would err on the side of caution and would hope that before we went to that extreme that we might work to come up with a compromise or support these initiatives. When we talk medical education, it's been pointed out we are unique in the state of Minnesota that we, to this point, have provided support in that area. And thinking back on some of the testimony that this committee has heard over time and that we've heard in the policy committee, it troubles me that we are entertaining ideas to diminish that need in our state. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'd remind you that this is federal mandate and we don't have any control over this. And so in order to maximize the federal dollars, this is really the step that we need to take. And while I understand your situation and wanting to protect your hospitals, I would be in the same situation. I would want to do that. I don't think that we should hold up the bill. That can still be done as an appropriation through the general fund. And I think that we need to move forward to capture as many federal dollars as possible.
Senator Prettner-Solon, I agree with you, but I do think that at least at this point, this is not a federal mandate. It is federal government is moving in a direction to cause us to change the allocation of these Merck dollars, but it is not a mandate at this point that we move to the extreme. Senator
Madam Chair, I think back to Senator Sharon's original question. While I realize that it's not going to probably alleviate your your discomfort or your support for this amendment, I think we could probably change the $1 million to $4
million. I was going to propose five, so...
Senator Sharon, 0.5. Do you have an amendment?
Madam Chair.
I'd like to amend on line, on page 8, line 8.7, the appropriation from $1 million to $5
million. On Senator Sharon's...
Madam Chair.
First of all.
A discussion.
First of all. One moment.
We'll go to Senator Cornyn and then Senator Olson.
First of all, Senator Berglund did not move the amendment. So we have to move the amendment before
right.
we
know it.
I move the A3
amendment. On the
A3 amendment,
Senator Berglund moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor?
Madam Chair, could I speak to the amendment?
We can amend the amendment before we adopt it. Okay. I think that might be better in this case.
We can amend the amendment before we adopt it. And I move an amendment to the amendment.
to change, Senator Sharon.
Change line 8.7 to... appropriate $5 million.
On Senator Sharon's amendment on line 8.7, is there any discussion? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would just like to say, as much as I recognize and appreciate the value of education and the fact that it benefits the whole state, I think the reason these changes were made is because, and federally, why we're concerned about the direction that it seems that we're going to be going is that these dollars were tied to dollars that were intended to serve low-income populations. And because of the arguments, I think, for the value of education to Mayo Clinic and because of the significance of that, they've been shifted away from the poor, the following the hospitals that serve a larger percentage of poor communities. I don't like to see dollars taken away from Mayo either. However, I would have to say that if we increase the number that's going to come out of the general fund, because we are taking, then that means that that we're going to have less money for the programs that we've all been presenting here that are more directly tied to, some of them directly tied to providing for the needs of the poor. And so we're, in some sense, we're stealing money from the poorest people in our community and transferring it to serve the needs of the of one particular hospital. And so I would be opposed to the amendment because I think that we have seen such a struggle with people on the lowest end of the economic scale in terms of the cuts that they've seen in access to programs across the board. And taking money away from those programs is not something that I feel like I support.
Okay. I'm going to take questions on Senator Sharon's amendment. Are there questions from members of the committee?
Yes.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Before I vote on the amendment, I would like to know, Madam Chair, a little bit more about your bill. Bill.
Senator Rosen.
About the governor's proposal or your bill that you have not had a hearing on. Can you explain a little bit more? Perhaps we need to have a further discussion before we go voting on something like this.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, it's identical to the governor's budget page, except instead of taking the $16 million from the Health Care Access Fund, Senator Lynch's bill would take it from the general fund. And I felt like we've had presentations of the governor's budget page. We had a hearing on the governor's budget bill. You know, it's just a decision of which fund you take the money out of. So,
thank you, Matt. Thank you, Senator Berglund.
Questions on the amendment, Senator Cornyn.
Well, Madam Chair, I think this is on the amendment, but this is to Senator Berglund. Let's say hypothetically this would not pass. What would that mean? Could you just give me a quick summary of what would that mean and what kind of dollars are we talking about?
Well, the amendment I presented had $1 million in it.
No, I mean the bill. This amendment that you have.
Bill?
Yeah, what if it doesn't?
Well,
Senator Berglund.
We have the base bill, which is trying to leverage, correct our match for the DSH money so that we can get the DSH money both this biennium and in the next biennium.
I understand that.
I assume everyone on the committee supports that. You all voted for it earlier.
Right.
So the issue would be the amendment.
Right.
And if you don't want the amendment, then don't vote for the amendment. But I wouldn't think you'd want to vote against the whole bill.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair,
Senator Coring.
And Senator Berglund, so if we don't pass the amendment, are we still going to be able to capture the DISH money?
Senator Berglund.
Yes. Madam Chair and Senator Coring, the DISH money is a separate issue.
Okay.
That's what's in the base bill. What's before us now is the amendment. The amendment deals with Merck.
Okay.
Okay, I want to go back to Senator Sharon.
And my amendment to the amendment deals with a change in the appropriations on page 8. So that's a separate issue. And I just would say to that the concern about drawing money from the general fund, that there the investment in medical education has its value. It goes way beyond what – it's not about the Mayo Clinic. It's not about – St. Mary's Hospital. It's about the commitment that are made in certain places where good medical education, excellent medical education can occur that prepares people to be able to serve the public, including those who have the most need. So this really is not, this really shouldn't be framed, I don't think, at all in the notion of who gets and who doesn't get based on their level of need. Whenever we're talking about medical education, it's hard to think about that maybe in terms of the neediest population, but it is this. We need these physicians to be able to be available and serve the people, no matter what their level of income is. And this is a significant change. And I'm simply suggesting that as compared to what, quick numbers, $14, $15, maybe $16 million change, for this system that's made a commitment to medical education to have to absorb, I think, is very significant. And I think that I don't think it's too much to say in the interim that we would offer $5 million from the general fund. We can negotiate that as we go on, but I think that this committee ought to speak to that.
Senator Berglund. Chair, you know, if Senator Sharon's amendment passes, I would take it to mean that the committee would like to see more cushioning of the blow. Obviously, we still have to put all the numbers together in the bill and see what we have money for, just like we do with all the other bills that we've had before us. So that's what I would interpret it to mean.
All right. Is there any further discussion on Senator Sharon's amendment to line 8.7? Okay. I think we'll take that question first. So on Senator Sharon's verbal amendment to change line 8.7 from 1 million to 5 million. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No. Aye.
The amendment is adopted. And I'd like to ask if there's any further discussion or comment on the A3 amendment as amended. Senator Berglund moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. Motion is, the amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, then I would move that Senate File 842 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Aye. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Berglund.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Senator Berglund, do we no longer have the April 1st deadline on the DISH money?
Right.
Okay. Senator
and
Berglund.
Because we didn't have the April 1st deadline and because the bill, base bill itself now is showing some savings, I don't quite understand why, but anyway, we brought it back so it could go in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, members. care bill next.
Madam Chair, if we could take 1033 first.
That would be fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1033 is a bill that proposes increased funding to address problem and compulsive gambling issues among many Minnesotans. 3% of Minnesota adults may have a problem that puts them and their families at financial and emotional risk. Moreover, 1 in 3 Minnesotans know a person with a gambling problem. The small percentage of persons who gamble problematically suffer enormous social, economic, and psychological implications. Individuals, families, and communities all suffer from problem gambling. As gambling continues at a brisk pace in Minnesota and more individuals and families seek help, more services will be needed to address all the issues surrounding problem gambling. We will need to increase efforts across the board to address the demands and issues associated with education, public awareness, problem assessment, and treatment, as well as invest in rigorous research endeavors to study the social and economic costs and to provide a comprehensive evidence-based response. I think this bill will help to address these concerns. And Madam Chair, I do have an amendment. Actually, I have the A5 amendment and a verbal amendment.
We have the A5 amendment in our packet. So, Senator Solon, if you want to just give us your changes.
Madam Chair, actually, what the A5 amendment does is it removes a portion that would have, I think, required treatment in corrections facilities or corrections to pay for it. This actually says that the lottery funds will also pay for the treatment that is done in corrections. It's expected to be a small amount, but it usually is assessments that are done in jail settings and things like that.
So do you have a change to the A5 amendment orally?
No, actually, it's another amendment.
Okay. Then why don't we go ahead with the A5 amendment? Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A5 amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair, on page 2, line 26, what I would like to do is put the delete everything after commissioner up to the period. And the reason for this is that we did add language in a previous committee to have the commissioner standardize the reimbursement rate, but what this does is it holds the commissioner to a maximum of $100 per assessment by statute. We would like the commissioner to make that determination. So it would be to delete everything after commissioner up to the period on 2.26.
Okay. So you've heard the oral amendment. Are there any questions or any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The oral amendment is adopted.
Okay. And so, Madam Chair, just briefly going through the bill, Section 1 expands treatment to include residents in a temporary or permanent residential setting for mental health or chemical dependency and individuals in jails or correctional facilities. Section 2 is now deleted. Section 3 requires the Commissioner of Human Services to standardize reimbursement rates for compulsive gambling assessments. Section 4 requires the Commissioner to facilitate a statewide study on the social and economic costs of gambling. Issues studied that are to be addressed are they're in the bill. Subdivision 2 is numbers 1 through 6. And then Section 5 appropriates $300,000 from the lottery prize fund to the Commissioner of Human Services to fund services for compulsive gambling in general, and this will be used specifically for education, assessment, and treatment. And it also appropriates under Subdivision 2 $100,000 per year for the biennium to the Commissioner of Human Services to continue the study currently being done on compulsive gambling and the long-term effects of gambling. Today I have with me Steve Dettinger, who is Executive Director of Gamblers Intervention Services at Lake Superior Family Services in Duluth, but he is also a board member for North Star Problem Gambling Alliance, and he'll briefly testify to why this bill is needed to address the growing gambling industry in Minnesota, and then we will stand for questions. So, Mr. Dettinger.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Steve Dettinger. I'm Executive Director of Gamblers Intervention Services in Duluth, and we're one of the original gambling treatment outpatient programs in the state of Minnesota. We've been a contractor with the state since 1992. I have been around since the inception of the very first gambling bills and the lottery, of which 245-98 was a part of, and have been an advocate for many years that we needed to expand our services and to support those services with funding so that we could reach the capacity that we know is needed out there by the Department of Human Services. I think this bill goes a long ways to help the department be able to act at a capacity level, at the same time doing good research that will help us do better evidence-based services in the state and get a better handle on what are the implications of problem gambling socially and economically so that we can make a better response. And I also would just add that this bill does get directly at many of the goals the Department of Human Services has put in its report to the governor as to the department's direction with gambling treatment services. So really I see this as an enhancement and a win-win situation for everyone. In the final analysis, it does not affect the budget you have to deal with because these are lottery dollars that are going into the funds directly, and I think that's an important item, and I know that the lottery stands behind this and endorses it. Thank you.
Any questions?
So, Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 1033 as amended. Do you want this laid over?
Yes.
Be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Okay, Senator Solon, you want to take your next one?
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I'm sorry that Senator Erickson Ropes left because there are this bill sort of talks to some of her demonstration project and is an example of something that might be similar. Senate File 726 is the bill that I have to present to you today, and I'm here with representatives from my district who have been diligently working on a community-based approach to increasing access to health care in the Duluth area. They are part of the Twin Ports Health Access Program, a program which implemented several initiatives to reduce the number of uninsured in the area. And we are all well aware that there is a growing number of uninsured in our state. The most recent study by the Minnesota Department of Health indicates the number of uninsured increased from 5.7% in 2001 to 7.4% in 2004. The biggest change is the dramatic decrease in employer-based coverage. In 2001, 68% of businesses offered health insurance. In 2004, that dropped to 62%, which is a 6% decrease. And of those 6% who lost employer-based health insurance, 4% are enrolled in our public programs, and nearly 2% moved into the ranks of the uninsured. Both of these trends are disturbing. This same report by the Minnesota Department of Health indicates that the vast majority of the uninsured work, and most work full-time. Those involved in the Twin Ports Access Program have studied this issue and have researched national models for increasing access for the uninsured. One model that has been successful in other parts of the country is the multiple share coverage model. This model actively engages business, local health care organizations, and the community in expanding health coverage. Multiple share programs focus on expanding health coverage to those working in small businesses, the people who are most likely to be uninsured. I had the opportunity to hear directly from the multiple share model from the director of a successful program that has operated for 7 years in Muskegon, Michigan. I have also spoken with representatives from the statewide program operating in Oklahoma, and I believe this type of program has potential here in Minnesota. Last year, the legislature approved a multiple share demonstration project in four counties of northeastern Minnesota. During the past year, the Twin Ports Health Access Program has further developed the program and has a funding proposal to the legislature for just over $1 million. Now, this $1 million is a one-time request to provide partial funding for the five-year project, and that is $200 per year for 5 years. The $1 million state contribution will be matched by a local foundation in Duluth, which is Generations Healthcare Initiatives, and also funding from other sources. And now I'd like to turn to Jenny Peterson's of Generation Healthcare Initiative to tell you more about the multiple share program that they call Health Share. And I have a couple of other testifiers. We'll be brief, Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jenny Peterson, and I work with the Generations Healthcare Initiatives. Our foundation is located in Duluth, and we focus solely on healthcare issues. Our major focus is on expanding healthcare access to the underinsured and underserved populations. We facilitate a community-wide effort called the Twin Ports Health Access Program. The program that we are presenting today is called HealthShare. It provides a means for small business employing low-wage workers to offer health coverage to their employees. Studies indicate that 75% of the uninsured are employed. 75%. Three-quarters of this population work full-time, and about half of them work for small businesses. In our area, 80% of the members of the Duluth Chamber of Commerce are small businesses. And in the recent chamber survey, the number one concern was the cost of health care benefits. We also have conducted focus groups in our area, and what we hear most often from small employers who don't offer health care insurance is that the current products available are unaffordable. We also conducted focus groups with uninsured employees in small business, and they said the same message. When we ask what is affordable for small businesses, they say between $50 and $100 a month per employee per month. When we asked employees what they felt was an affordable cost, they said the same thing, about $50 to $100 per month. HealthShare is a multiple share coverage program patterned after a proven national model. I want to summarize three key features of that program. First is the design of a low-cost health coverage program. It directly involves local businesses and the local healthcare community. It focuses on primary care, intervention, and individualized care management. Health services in this type of plan are only available at participating providers in a geographic area. In Muskegon County, Michigan, the program that we're using as our prototype, the total cost of the program is roughly $160 a month per person per month. The second feature I want to point out is that this program has a community fund. When we look at the issue of the uninsured, it really is a community issue that involves many partners. In Muskegon, Michigan, a community fund is established, and with that, the employer pays into this program, and the employer pays $50 or 30% of the cost. The employee also pays $50 or 30% of the cost, and the community fund augments that care at the tune of about $60 per person per month. So this is a shared responsibility with the community having a fund that helps to augment the cost. The third key aspect is that the business is eligible in this type of program, and this is very different than a number of programs we see. It is not, it is more of a mainstream approach and follows the model that we currently have operating now. You can debate whether that's a good model or bad model, but that's what we have at present. This type of program is not a social service model. It does not require income or asset means testing. The business is eligible if they are a small business, in other words, employ 50 or fewer employees. Secondly, that they have not offered health insurance in the past 12 months. And third, that the median wage within that business is $12.50 an hour or less. This equates to, if you look at the figure 1250, that's about 275% of poverty. So if the median wage is 1250, and we know that many of our service workers do make less than that, the business would be eligible. In the bill before you, the Twin Ports Health Access Program requests the state be a partner in funding HealthShare. As Yvonne mentioned, we have local funding from our foundation and from other sources that will match the requests that we've been asking. We are asking for $1,050,000. The $1 million is for the community share, the community fund. The $50,000 would fund a comprehensive evaluation that could be used as a learning for other for possible expansion of this program. I want to reiterate that this is a small investment of about $200,000 per year over a five-year period. Also recall that the employers pay a portion of this fund, as do the employees. We see HealthShare as a very strategic approach in expanding health care to a population that is most likely to be uninsured, those who are working and work in small businesses. This program in Northeast Minnesota will serve as a demonstration project for the entire state, and we ask your support of Senate File 726 because it's an innovative coverage program.
Senator Prettner-Solon, we have another bill yet on the agenda, and so I'm going to stop here and see if there are questions. I guess the main question I have is, do you need $1 million, or could you get by with $200,000 per year for a shorter period of time?
Ideally, we would like the five-year program. In following the Muskegon model, you know, it takes about that long till it actually gets up and going, and can appear to be somewhat self-sustainable after that time. So our ideal is the $1 million for 5 years.
I understand. We all have ideals. Are there other questions?
Madam Chair, would you like me to move the bill?
Yes.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 726 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Just one more question, and that is, if we were to fund this, then at the end of the demonstration period, it's not envisioned that the state would be out of subsidizing this. As I understand it, you're just trying to demonstrate that businesses want to be involved with this and there would be a need for a continuing subsidy?
We don't foresee the need for a continuing subsidy.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Prettner-Solon moves that
Senate File 726, Madam Chair.
Senate File 726 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Senator Sharon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to present Senate File 2754, which is a proposal for a pilot project for a regional children's mental health initiative. Because I know that our time is very short, I'm going to defer comments to our testifiers. But I do want to emphasize that as you listen to the discussion about this bill, that you notice that this is an initiative that involves 11 counties coming together to create a collaborative approach to dealing with children's mental health initiatives. So with that, I will turn this over with your permission, Madam Chair, to the persons who are here to talk with you about this proposal.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Susan Rinda, Director of Human Services with Lee Seward County. And I will honor your short time frame as well. Try to be as brief as possible. I wanted to just talk about our regional approach. I was before your committee a couple of years ago with the department to talk about our adult mental health initiative. And as Senator Sharon has talked about, we are in South Central Minnesota, 11 counties, and we have formed a regional management team structure since 1996
to organize around that adult mental health initiative. We have a wonderful governance structure. We have a regional management team that consists of consumers that sit at the table and are voting members. And we have various advisory councils and stakeholders meetings. The regional partners have gotten together to identify that we really would like to duplicate or replicate the Adult Mental Health Initiative for Children's Mental Health as well. And so we've identified going forward in joining forces and tried to create a system that could also link, have the ability to integrate with the adult mental health system for youth in transition. And we've identified a number of unmet needs. So moving into more of a vision of more consistent practice standards throughout our communities, we do recognize that counties have unique needs and service delivery opportunities and challenges. However, there are common issues we all deal with. And if we work together to plan, coordinate, develop, and share resources, we can produce greater results and set a higher standard of care for children and their families. We would certainly embrace best practices and standardization of practice, and we have a few examples already. We want to focus on out-of-home care and placements and standard protocols of operations. Another would be providing increased mental health trainings and support to parents and foster parents to enhance opportunities for stabilization in the community. We truly want to keep children in their communities and closer to home. And then the third component I want to talk about is the effectiveness and measured outcomes. Through our children's regional management team, and its areas of focus will be an investment in the children and families of South Central Minnesota, but benefits can impact our entire state. Each of the focus areas described in our proposal can serve as a laboratory for improving quality and reducing costs of services. And we propose a number of actions in that area. And I will not go through all of those in the interest of time, but do want to wrap up in some of our examples of success in our initiative. And the number one being involving consumers, family members in the planning process. At our recent stakeholder meeting, we had over 250 consumers that attend to get education about mental health services in our area. We really want to build upon those successes. And another has been our reduction in long-term use of institutionalization care. Prior to the closure of RTCs and the expansion of the community-based health hospitals, we had reduced over 80% of utilization at the regional treatment center. We would like to do some similar focus around out-of-home placement and keeping kids in the community as well. And I will turn it over to Phil Claussen for the remainder of the presentation.
And I have just a couple of questions. I'm going to put them out now so that we don't run out of time. These counties currently do receive funding for what's called the Children's Mental Health Collaborative. And I'm wondering if you receive this funding, if you would be willing to give up that funding, or if we're going to just keep building more and more kind of collaboratives.
Madam Chair, Phil Claussen, Blue Earth County Human Services. The answer to that question is that it is true that we do have Children's Mental Health and Family Services Collaboratives, but it is the area that got cut very dramatically in the last several years. So the prevention work that has historically gone on through the collaboratives has been cut to the point where it really does not exist anymore. And really the components of this project are about bringing in integrated care, which we don't currently have with primary health, behavioral health, social services, and the families, and also looking at another component that is listed about flexible funding that also does not currently exist. And we think flexible funding, just like on the adult side that Sue talked about, is the key to really filling these gaps where we think a lot of people fall into and a lot of kids fall into. So the passion we have for what's new and different is not to create more coordination efforts, but to really look at flexible funding and case coordination that has been part of this whole integrated approach in healthcare, and do that in a very different and significantly different way. And that's why we need the funding. And that's that. The power of this is really in the fact that we do have 11 counties saying this has to be a standardized approach that is going to be different from what we've historically had. We do want to look at some of the prevention that has gone away recently.
Mr. Claussen, with all due respect, the existing children's mental health collaboratives were intended to provide flexible funding, carves out a portion of the health care plans, Medicaid dollars on the table, the county dollars, school district dollars, and in some cases dollars that are being spent by the courts on mental health for the children. So again, I just ask you whether I realize that those funds have been cut, but they were not eliminated.
Madam Chair, to answer that issue, I think the specifics that we're looking at and some of the things that I know have been before this committee are really looking at employment and vocational supports for older adolescents who transition into adulthood, certainly specialized care and medication management. But then the real specific things that I would ask for your consideration are a list of the flexible funding pieces that I'm talking about, and this is about providing bus tokens to families, getting them involved in sports, the clothing, helping with funds so that they don't lose housing. These are areas that we have not been able to tap into because those monies are defined for specific purposes. So we're not asking to duplicate case management per se. We're looking to establish some things that are not currently happening.
Mr. Klassen, with all due respect, the money that's brought together by the collaborative can be spent on anything the collaborative decides to spend it on, including the things you've mentioned, if that's what they choose to do.
And, Madam Chair, I'm just referring back to our collaborative. We really have gone through a layoff. We have no staff left in those positions. We do not provide this, and we are not spending on other things. It does not exist. What we try to do in children's mental health is get children hooked up with therapy and other medical assistance dollars that are already in place through previous channels. So that's our reality, and I'm not sure in Lasua County if there's a different.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would echo that as well. We have a family services collaborative, which has dwindled down to trying to support a CD counselor in schools and serving their bilingual population. But there isn't a lot of room for extras and flexible funding that one would like to see. That reality just isn't there. And we were hoping in our regional approach to, as we know that the collaboratives are different in different areas, that we would be able to try to merge and consider those things. But we really don't have the funding for the flexible funding and some of the things we would like to do in this pilot. It isn't a possibility at this point, unfortunately.
Madam Chair, just one more comment, if you'll indulge me, is the issue of out-of-home placement is another big issue that I know you've heard about from counties. And we believe that through a standardized approach, if we regionalize our care through this project, we'll be able to set up practice standards that also don't exist. So I appreciate your concerns, but we are not looking to supplant or to duplicate any services that currently exist in our region. We have a history of working really well together, and we feel like this would create a platform where we could look at standardized care around placement, much like what's happened on the adult side, where we've gotten away from institutional care and regional treatment centers. We need to do that in children's mental health, and we do not have resources to do that right now, would be my testimony.
Other questions? Senator Sharon,
do you have a motion that this be laid on the table and considered in the and laid over to be considered in the omnibus bill?
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, members, for your patience. We have a list we'd like to hand out before you go of all the bills that we have fiscal notes on that have been heard in the division so far for people to be able to ponder as we have the very hard job of selecting only a very few of these.
We'll see for millions of dollars in requests.